Hi, my name is Michael Richardson. I'm a software engineer at, actually, I'm a software designer since I don't wear a ring, a company called Solidum Systems. We are a maker of a gigabit packet classification technology. And I'm here to talk a bit about our experiences in making our prototype fast Ethernet card work under Linux. And some of the various problems we went through and some of the calculations that we did along the way. In brief, one of the interesting questions is why would we even bother putting our multi-gigabit hardware under Linux? That we'll discuss. Some budgeting processes here. How much time do you have? How much time does it take? And how do the two numbers intersect? Here I'll also talk about the traditional framework for packet processing that you see most clearly in a BSD Net3 stack, less clearly in a Linux stack because of some other optimizations, and a different framework that's emerging from vendors like us and other vendors like Elteon and Packet Engines and people like that, to build smarter NIC cards that offload a lot of the processing. And then we'll spend most of our time on future work, and I'm hoping that many of you have some ideas that interact here. I would urge you please to interrupt me at any time you like. Use the mic or not use the mic. As you wish, wave at me frantically. I'd rather you ask your question in the middle than wait for the end. It's more interesting that way for all of us, I think. Welcome, I guess. So, why use Linux as a router? A lot of you probably maybe tell me how many who actually have boxes with more than one network card in them. So not all of you, but quite a few of you. So, you know, the question of why didn't you go and buy a Cisco 2500 emerges. Okay, they're not that expensive. I mean, they are expensive, but they're not that expensive. They do a lot of things pretty well. And, you know, the question is, for a lot of people, why didn't they do that? And the answer is, well, I had the hardware. It was cheap. I put another NIC card in it, and that was it, and that was a router. Right? It's also my desktop, by the way, and I run X and you know, all this other stuff on it, by the way. And then I decided I needed a dedicated router, so I found another box, and then it became my new server as well as my router, and you know, people have stories like that that go on. And the answer is the reason why you put multiple NIC cards in Linux and Unix boxes is because it's a useful thing to do. And one of the things that made it very useful for over time is that people have done things. I mean, someone came along and said, hey, look, you know, IPFWadmin didn't quite do what we wanted. So Darren Reed ported IPF. So we actually have a choice of two different firewalling packages under Linux, which work to different degrees in different spaces. And that was easily done. You know, there wasn't like the firewalling thing. You could always disagree and you could always insert something else. All of those various, you know, fragment attacks and things like that, which unfortunately Linux was vulnerable to at times, those were very easily spotted and very easily fixed, and a number of other bugs were fixed, as I understand, in the same patch. Someone said, oh, but look, it happens here too. And that was easy to do, and as a result, you know, you didn't have to install hot fix of the day. You sort of just upgraded your kernel after 2 weeks and everything was solved. I don't know if you've been in this situation of having to figure out how some piece of code works. For instance, Netlink is terribly badly documented. Probably the only thing you can really find out or learn about Netlink is by reading the source code. And that's about it. I mean, in this worst case, you can always read the source code. It may take you longer. You may still not understand. I still don't understand all of Netlink, that's for sure. But it's there, and if I put a bit more effort in, I would understand it, and I might even write a document explaining it to it. So finally, the other reason to have a Linux firewall or QoS box or router is because you can run X on it if you want to. You can SSH into the thing. You can telnet. You can have a serial console if you still want to, you know, pretend it really looks like a Cisco router. And you can do all these things. So there's a lot of, you know, big advantages to having a really multi-purpose box there. It's very nice. Of course, we know what happened in the high-speed world. We replaced Unix boxes, many of them were Suns, Sun 3s, things like that, Sun 2s, with Cisco routers that ran on the same hardware, even slower hardware. Many of you, if you look inside your Cisco 2500, you would find 33 megahertz, 68,040. Not what you have on your desktop, you know, 400 megahertz Pentium. I mean, what you have on your desktop really just completely kills CPU-wise anything you'll find in the Cisco router. And yet the Cisco router does better than most Unix machines. And they bet on the fact that they could do it all in software. People like Bay or Wellfleet and the other people that they were formed from, they thought, well, this is silly. You should be able to do all of this in hardware. And they were right and they were wrong. We know they were wrong because they lost the war and Cisco won it. And they're very small, and Nortel owns them now. On the other hand, they were right in the sense that there's no way that Cisco can manage more than a couple OC3s right now. You can't do gigabit through a Cisco 7000. It's very, very hard. There's people making a lot of money selling routing accelerators for Cisco boxes, which are basically custom pieces of silicon. Why? The software couldn't go fast enough. So now we're in this situation that if you'd like to continue to build a router with Linux, you have this problem of, I can't really go fast enough. Suddenly, if I wanted to put, you know, a four-port Linux box between the three, four parts of my network to have it sort of act as a bit of a firewall between my, you know, my admin people and my network hackers and, you know, these other people, as a bit of a firewall as well as a router, well, you can't, because suddenly you can't get very much bandwidth through it. And that becomes a problem, and it means that it's going to be less fun to hack. It's going to be less ability to really use it in real situations. So we did a bit brief calculation. I apologize. I thought I fixed this. The time for frames, each number should have an extra zero on it. I thought I fixed that last night. I didn't, I guess. And what we have here is a table that we sort of calculated. At 10 megabits per second, you get about 14,000, 15,000 packets per second. If you assume minimum length packets, 64-byte Ethernet frames, and a minimal interframe gap. In gigabit, you actually can do away with the interframe gap, so it gets a little bit faster, but it's an optional feature. Also in gigabit, you can go to 9,000 byte packets, which makes things a bit more efficient for some things. But if you're worried about someone ping flooding you, what you care about is 64 byte packets. How many people have been ping flooded at 10 megabits per second? How about 100? Did you have to reboot? You think it hung? Yeah. I can demonstrate the same thing over here on the table here. It'll hang. You won't survive a ping flood at 100 megabit. It just... Pardon me? The machine was conducting the ping flood. Flood was pretty slow as well? Okay, so I mean that, you know, but if you imagine it's quite easy to get 10 or 15 people to gang up on you on a fast LAN, and you'll go down pretty quickly. So at 14,000 packets per second, you get about 66 microseconds, or 66,000 nanoseconds. I put it in nanoseconds for ease, and I first time through, I forgot the zero. And I guess I still have that here. So not seen on the right-hand side of my slide is it says you get about 6,500 cycles. So I'm going to give you 1 microsecond to get the data across your PCI bus into RAM, or half a microsecond, another half a microsecond to get the data across your PCI bus into your transmit buffers. So you like to be a router, you have to, of course, receive the packet and then transmit the packet. If you're going to go buy some switch fabrics from AT&T or Lucent or Nortel or someone like this, well, you can do cut-through switching and things like that. But generally speaking, the routers that we talk about building under Linux, they're going to have a PCI backplane with some RAM and several NIC cards. And it's going to be store and forward. So you get 6,500 cycles on a Pentium at 100 megahertz to do something with. That's quite a lot, actually, all things considered. It's not hugely generous. I mean, you certainly can't paint the packets on the screen, you know, as they go by, but you can do quite a lot in 6,500 cycles. All right, this is why Cisco has been winning, because they realize that they can optimize their code to work at that speed in assembly. Now, if you go to 100 megabit per second, you see you get, you know, basically 10 times more packets. There's some rounding there for 10, and you get about 6.6 microseconds to handle each packet. Again, add a zero. So that gives you 650 CPU cycles at 100 megahertz. It's not a lot, considering that's 100 megahertz, and that you have to deal with cache stalls, you have to deal with pipelines being messed up when you branch the wrong way. If you're lucky, your RAM runs on 100 megahertz, so you can actually pull things out possibly on every cycle of 100 megahertz if everything's working to your benefit. So that also means, by the way, that you only get to do 650 memory cycles. So even if you have a 500 megahertz CPU, at most, you can access 650 words of data. That's quite a lot, because IP header is only 5 words in size, and if that's all you have to look at, that's great. But you might have to look at the routing table. You might have to look through all those things, and that's where it suddenly gets, you know, the budget becomes quite a clear problem. So at gigabit, well, you get 660 nanoseconds. By the way, that's on the same order of time as it takes to cross the PCI bus. So in fact, there's almost nothing left for you. Okay? And I've put 65 there, and that's in some ways is a mistake, but if you ignore the PCI bus crossing time, you get 65 CPU cycles at 100 megahertz. That's not enough, frankly, for an Intel CPU to save its registers. Okay? So forget about interrupts or anything like that. You're in polling mode, that's for sure. And I really hope that you have a lot of things. You probably need multiple CPUs if you're going to try to do this in software. The number is, I don't know, it's quite high. Depends on what your cycle counts are and how good an assembly language programmer you think you are. So at this point, you've really entered the realm of you're now selling routers, or you're building routers that compete with Cisco routers. They're not running Linux, really. They certainly aren't running X. There's no time left for that. You're not going to be able to SSH into them, because I don't really think you're going to have anything left to do anything left with it. Source code, well, it's now assembly, by the way. So I hope you know Pentium, assembly language, and that kind of stuff. So all of the nice advantages of having, you know, it run Linux have sort of evaporated. And your effort to maintain it has gone up, and probably if I were just faced with this, you know, simple problem with no other options, I would just say, yeah, thank you very much, Cisco, here's my check. I mean, I can't compete with that. They have people working full-time doing this thing. So the question is what do we do next? Well, let's see how bad it really is. If I haven't convinced you, it's bad. We did some profiling using the Pentium cycle counters of the PCNet 32 driver. Certainly not the most optimized driver in the world. The Tulip drivers do much better generally. But for various reasons, it's the chip that we had to put in our card. It has certain attributes which are very nice features. It is the chip of choice on Spark and some other systems. So what you see is that it took us 1,048 cycles to get from the beginning of when the Linux interrupt service routine code got control into our device driver. So this is all the overhead, you know, of saving the context and figuring out where the interrupt came from and things like that. And 1,048 is pretty high, but it's okay because we can process several thousand packets on each interrupt. So it's just an overhead. You don't really have to worry about that. But it was an interesting number, because we wondered if perhaps that it was taking maybe multiple microseconds to get in. In fact, that our card was overrunning itself in just the time it took to take one interrupt. So that wasn't the case. Then we went down our list of things to measure, and we sort of stopped after the second item. We discovered that on average it took 4,000 cycles just to acknowledge that a packet was received to the MNIC. So this didn't involve doing any other processing. This didn't involve figuring out what kind of packet it was. We didn't pass the packets up at all to the next layer. They didn't go through the bottom half. We just dropped them right there. We made sure that we weren't allocating new buffers for the packet. We were just reusing the ones that were there. And yet, the loop, on average, was taking 4,000 cycles per packet. This is dependent upon our specific CPU. It was measured on a specific CPU at a specific megahertz with a specific cache size. I could tell you what those all are. I don't have them on me right now.
So it's hardware, right?
It would be hardware. I mean, it was a 200 megahertz K6 with, I think, the normal 1 megabyte of L2 cache. No particular great optimizations. It was just C code. More examination of the C code says that there's probably a lot of things in there that we could optimize. Okay, there's some array references when there should be pointer references to some things. There's a fact that due to the architecture of our card, we have to cross the PCI bus to get to the receive descriptor ring rather than having it in system memory. The buffers themselves live in system memory, so that's okay. But so there's some issues there that are a problem. We figure that we can easily cut this number in half. That wouldn't be a problem, just with changes in the C code. No assembly, no anything else.
Throw a faster processor,
right. So we can get a 400 megahertz Pentium. Okay. Pardon me? It's not that big. It's not a big deal. If you can go, it's doable, okay. And it's doable, especially with the fast routing code. It's doable to get routing easily at 100 megabits if you know what you're doing, okay. It's possible. It takes a bit of it takes some attention to detail. You have you have about 650 cycles per packet to deal with, so that's an average number that you get. So you have to pay a bit in overhead. So basically that number has to go down by about 10 times to about 400 cycles. If you can do that, that's great. Now I'll also say this is minimum length packets. Now a real router deals with a statistical average of maximum length packets and minimum length packets, which with a couple in the 700 byte range. Okay? So in fact you can do much, you can do better than this if you want. But you can't do this if you're dealing with certain things. Some of our applications, people are building network analyzers out of Linux boxes or NT boxes on our card. So for us, they can't deal with the concept that statistically you're going to capture all the packets, but in a worst case scenario, oops, we lost all the key packets. So we really have to cope with minimum sized packets. And if you want to cope with someone ping flooding you at 100 megabits per second, I don't mean waiting for the packets to come back, which is what flood does. I mean sending them at full speed. And you want to recover from that thing to actually get enough CPU to do something. Well, you're going to have to cope with minimum size packets, and that's a key thing. You have to cope, for a security point of view, you have to cope with worst case timing. Otherwise, they do a denial of service attack, and it's very, very easy to do. Now, at gigabit, remember I said we had 65 cycles at 100 megahertz to deal with it. So I have a 200 megahertz processor here, so I get 130. So I don't know how you get to 130 per packet. You don't. You just hope that nobody out there has enough bandwidth to kill you at that speed at this time. Which if you want to put a Linux box into some, you know, key part of the world, that's it's not going to fly. Question? No? Okay. So we have a bunch of other layers that we're very interested in because we're actually quite interested in interfacing them to them in out-of-band ways. We're interested specifically in being able to go from our card, which has intelligence that happens before the interrupt routine is even called, and we want to be able to jump right into some of these other parts. We'd like to know how efficient they are So far, we don't know that. This is future work that we're going to be doing. The best way to get into that is something we want to discuss later. So, I'm going to talk a bit about what exactly we're doing and what we have on the table and why we really care about all this stuff. Traditionally, this is sort of what a Net3 BSD stack will do to demux the packets. As you can see, it comes in, and one of the first things that happens in the hardware is you figure out, is it for me? Is this even addressed for me? And that happens in the hardware with a Mac. And it decides, is it me, is it unicast, multicast, broadcast? And if it is addressed to us and it's there, then it's received and it's put into memory. So that's the first layer that happens, and happens in the hardware. And if that didn't happen in the hardware at 10 megabit speeds in the days of 20 megahertz CPUs, or slower even, none of Ethernet would have worked at all, because they had a shared media and everybody heard everything that happened. So you had to pick out just your packets, and that's a very key thing. It's also a very simple check. It's very easy to do. The destination address is the first 6 bytes of the data. It's all there presented to you, nicely formatted, no problem. The next stage you have to do is in software. We have Ethernet 2, which, if you're familiar with it, means that you have a type field in the 13th and 14th byte, versus 802.3, who decided in their infinite wisdom that it would be appropriate to put a length field there instead. So you have this nice heuristic that says that if the length is less than 1,500 bytes, then it's a length field. And if it's greater than 1,500, well, it's a type field. And you can sort of guess by what's going on. I don't know what happens with jumbo packets, with 9,000 byte packets on gigabit, because the field for IP is 8000, and although that's 32K, so I'm sure there's some other numbers in there that Novell and other people do use that were less than 9,000 and that are either going to not work on gigabit, or I don't know exactly what will happen. But anyway, so you make the determination. If it's 802.3, well, then you have to skip a certain number of bytes to find the beginning of the packet. How many depends upon a lot of things about that type and what kind of encapsulation. Is it LLC? Is it snap? Is it this or that? And there's 3 or 4 different encapsulations that you can have. So you have to remove that if you want to cope with that. Mostly in the Unix world, we just use Ethernet 2. It's really simple. It's really dumb. But you still have to... There's all these other people that send this stuff that I won't mention in this room. So then we figure out, oh, is it ARP? Is it IPv6? Is it IPv4? What is it? So again, you make another determination step. You look at the protocol field. You look at the version numbers. You look at the Ethernet header to figure this stuff out. So there you go. So it's another stage. So that stage already happens in the bottom half of the driver. The Ethernet 2 versus 802.3 happens in the bottom half of the driver. The driver is somewhere between that unicast and in the middle point. So that's where the software first gets involved. And it usually does identify, was it unicast, multicast, or broadcast that was received? Sometimes the chip will tell you. Sometimes you have to look at the MAC addresses, the destination addresses, a second time so the software knows what it was. So finally you get in to say, okay, well, it's V4, it's TCP, our favorite HTTP protocol, and then which of 7,000 sockets does it belong to on my web server? There's this whole series of demuxing here that's happening, and eventually it finds itself into the right queue. This, as I say, is a traditional way to do it. There's a lot of enhancements. Linux kernel does a lot of hashing across the number of expected fields here, puts it all in a table, and hopes that it finds the right thing quite frequently. And when it doesn't, it goes through the slow path and does it the other way. So there's a bunch of things. And there's ways of doing, there's fast routing, which does some of this hashing between in the driver layer to figure out should it be forwarded at high speed to another interface. It doesn't work with every NIC card driver out there. Hasn't been ported to the driver that we're using. We'll eventually do that. But anyway, this is a traditional view. It's pretty simple to understand. If you like, we can even map ISO layers on top of this. It gets confusing as you go to the right, but you can do all this in your standard networking course, and everyone's very happy. Okay? But it's slow. That's the key thing, it's slow. So what we do, in fact, is much different. We don't put multiple layers. I mean, that's a nice abstraction for documentation. What we have instead is we have a standardized way to describe packets in the form of a packet description language. And we simply say, when packets look like IP with an Ethernet in front of it, and then they have some TCP ports, and one of them happens to be 25, and it's addressed for my IP address, and it's TCP, and it has the ACK bit set, and whatever, then put it in this first queue to SMTP. If it's, some other protocol, then you can describe them as you like, Apple Talk, if you want. We're not specific to IP. So we have all these things, and what you do is you generate this description, and at compile time of your kernel, you generate these descriptions, because typically you're not going to generate them. You're not going to have new protocols that you didn't know about compiled into your kernel or into your module without you knowing that they are there. So you do this at compile time. It takes a couple of minutes to translate the nice user-friendly description of the packet into a machine-readable format, and that gets loaded into our hardware at runtime. So some of the parameters, like the SPI numbers, the port numbers, the queue discipline numbers, whatever the various things are that you've declared as parameters, those are instantiated at runtime and get stuffed into our hardware. And our hardware makes this decision, this packet classification, and puts a number on each packet as it comes out of the hardware. The result is that what you get is you get, before the driver even gets a chance, so in other words, before we've even spent that first interrupt overhead even, we already know what the packet is for. All we have to do is examine it and then put it in the right queue, generally. There's nothing else to do. I had another point about the amount of time here. Oh, yes. The way that our hardware is designed, and not all everyone's hardware is designed the same way, but a lot of other people have very similar models, is that what happens for us is that the packet classification always happens before the packet has been DMA'd into memory. In fact, it happens as the packet goes bit by bit off the wire into memory. So by the time the last bit of the packet is there, because of the design of our system, it runs synchronously with the received data, which means that it's made a decision before the end of the packet, always, all right? And that if we can talk about this later, but essentially is a time-space trade-off, and we paid in space and got time, okay? Other people have other things involved, for instance, power-quick CPUs inside the Mac. That's what Altion does. Packet Engines has a very long instruction word CPU inside their Mac, which you have to get firmware for and upload to. PMC Sierra, which doesn't really make Macs that go on PCI cards, but rather in switches. They have also a very long instruction word. When I say very long, I mean 300 or 400 bits wide kind of instruction words that can do 17 different things in one cycle. And there's a bunch of different things like that people do. But the essential thing that happens is that everyone splits the packets into different flows, and it comes out of the chip in different flows. So, what is it we're really here to talk about? And that's really, I want to talk about some of our future work. We want to fill in the timing diagram. This is, stuff that's going to happen over the summer. We want to know how much time is spent each time. There's some people that have informed me that they have successfully done 100 megabits per second minimum size packets through tulip cards. And I'm skeptical, but I'm willing to listen to what why it works for you. Why is the speed of our driver so bad? Our PCNet 32 driver is, as I said, not the driver of choice for a lot of people. It was the chip of choice for us for technical reasons that involve what kind of pins it has had on the chip and things like that. So we had to use that, and we started with the Linux driver, and we discovered it was not doing very well. We're going to have to profile more. Pentium cycle counters are about the only way that I've reliably found to measure any of this, because if you put printfs in, you're burning multiple milliseconds to do that. and anything else, even kernel profiling, does sampling and tells you how many times you entered a certain function. I already know I'm in the function 100% of the time. I want to know which line number specifically is giving me problems. There are alpha profilers that will do that, for instance, but I'm not aware of one for the Pentium. If someone knows of one, great. So I just use the Pentium cycle counters. It's a register I read, and it tells me how many clock cycles have occurred since power on. And it's just a simple subtraction to figure out how long everything took. You have to do it multiple times. There's a lot of advice on various things. Intel will tell you everything you want to know about it. But you have to do it several times because you have to deal with, oh, the first time through the code, it wasn't in the instruction cache, and the second time the data wasn't there, and whatever. But that's okay. I'm sending 150,000 packets a second, so I'm pretty happy to go through it, you know, several hundred times or several hundred thousand times and average the number. We want to adapt the fast route code to work with our driver. Specifically, the model, which is that the driver knows and can figure out where the packet is destined to, which we can quite trivially do, and you drop it into the transmit queue of the other device in the interrupt service routine. The result is that the packet may hardly ever be in memory. It's almost as good as a real switch. The bridging code is the other interesting code, just because, you know, we think we're of layer 3 networking layer stuff. We can become a bridge just as easily. That's just doing routing on MAC addresses instead of IP addresses, and that's equivalently difficult to us as far as we're concerned. So it's almost the same problem. We want to have a better interface to the queue discipline code. Specifically, we want to be able to drop packets into outgoing queue disciplines from the driver layer. Right now, there's a long sort of path that it has to go to before it gets to the queue input of the outgoing interface. This is something that I hope to talk a lot with Werner and Jamal today about. How that's going to work. But what we think is that it should be quite simple. We should be able to pick which queue discipline to put the packet into, which scheduler to put the packet into on our card, and we should be able to just drop it into that queue and say, look, don't do any thinking about it. We already did the thinking. Just do the scheduling. Thank you. And that's all. Excuse me. So one of the interesting things for us is there's a lot of different code. There's IP firewalling, IP chains, which I guess is now written in terms of IP firewalls written in terms of IP chains. So it's really one item now. There's the queue discipline classifiers. There's CLIPS, IPsec, that has to classify packets. There is the multicast code that has to classify packets. There's just the routing code, as far as we're concerned, that classifies packets. That's the simplest of them all. And what we're going to be doing over time is working on figuring out what is the right way for us to represent these various people's requirements. Because what we would like to have is a table that says, well, I'm interested in this field, and this field, and this field. Some systems they do, it's too low level. They say, I'm interested in whether byte 14 is greater or equal than 4. And that's great. It's very easy to implement. Unfortunately, it doesn't map very well between, say, Ethernet 2 and 802.3 because the byte moves. It doesn't work if you have IP options because the bytes move. It doesn't work with TCP options. The bytes move. The packets get bigger and smaller. So what we'd rather the thing said is they said, I'm interested in if the destination IP address is 4. And a higher level representation of that. And if each module is able to express this fact, then we would be able to pull that information down into our card and drop the packet into the right queue, be it TCP queue or whatever is appropriate. So that's the kind of thing that we're here. Now, actually, I meant to show the demo between here and before I got here, and I didn't do that. I really hope to hook it up to the overhead, but we didn't get the. Someone else got the lone VGA extension cord that was found. So what I'm going to do is actually invite you to come up and look at the demo. I'll tell you a bit about it first. What you see is there are actually two computers there. One's under the table. You don't want to see it. It's the control software for the smart bits that you do see does not run on our favorite operating system. It does have a Tickle interface, which does run. It does ship for Linux, Solaris, and NT, which was quite nice, and it works just fine, except I don't know how to use it yet. Beyond that, it works quite well. So what you see is the smart bits, which is a commercial traffic generator and analyzer. It's got two cards in it that will do 10-100 megabit and two empty slots on the bottom. And what we have is it's right now generating about 10 packets per second. Why? For dramatic effect, really. The blue cable coming out of the front of it is plugged into the back of the PC with the glass case there. And inside is our card, and you'll see, if you probably have to bend down a little bit or have better eyesight than me, if you look carefully, there's two LEDs on the back of it. There's a red one and a green one. Red means reject. Green means accept. So in fact, if you were getting ping flooded, like this guy is being, you would be able to drop this guy's ping packets on the card. You wouldn't waste PCI bandwidth. You wouldn't take an interrupt. You wouldn't do anything. You'd just say, yeah, I don't care about you. I put you in my firewall rules. You're deny, and I don't even know you exist. We had complaints from firewall vendor that said, excuse me, but I'd like to audit those packets. You're too efficient. So we actually put an option in it so that it will fail to reject in hardware every 32,000 rejects, so the guy can do a little bit of auditing. If he likes, he can put the card in promiscuous mode and get every packet that's out there. That's another solution, but not something you want to do well. Because of the problems with our driver, we're not able to receive a full 100 megabits per second of data. We can process it on our card. So long as enough packets are rejected on our card, they don't get DMA'd and they don't show up, which means our effective throughput is much lower that we can count. So what's happening right now is we have 60 streams of data flowing out of the smart bits, right now at a slow speed, but I'll adjust the speed up in a moment. And our card has been programmed to be interested in 20 different flows. So in a certain sense, it's like a QoS demo where you have, you know, 60 people web surfing or whatever, 40 people web surfing and 20 people with voice calls, and you like to give priority over the voice calls, so you're picking those packets out on source address, destination address, ports, and things like that. And we actually have a demo you can put, part of the demo, you can type your birthday into the smart bits in the last 4 bytes of the 64-byte packet, and we can classify on that if you want to, because we don't really care where the data is in the packet. And all our driver is doing at this time is it's pulling the data off the wire, out of the receive descriptors and the receive buffers, and it's saying, aha, that was category one. I'll increment that counter, and then I'll drop it. And that's all our driver does, and that's all our tests have been interested in doing. And then we have a nice little GUI that someone hacked up in Qt, which has been rewritten in Visual Basic for NT last week. But until then, we have been taking this box to shows, and we'll probably continue taking it to shows and show it with this stuff with Linux running on it. And all it's doing is having a pretty bar chart of each one of those counters. And as you can, if you probably can't quite see, but or maybe you've noticed over the while you've been sitting here, the lines have slowly gone up. At 10 packets per second, it's really not that exciting. But I'll bump the speed up, and unfortunately, when you bump the speed up, the lights just stay on, and it's really boring. From a visual, you know, lights flashing point of view, because they just sort of stay on and that's it. So I'm using VNC to control the other guy. One of the criteria for making sure that our driver went fast enough is that if our driver takes up too much time, there's enough CPU to move the lines on the screen left. And marketing really didn't like the fact that it didn't work like that. So as you see, it's going a lot faster now. The light is on, transmit light is on constantly. I don't know if you can see the green and yellow lights there, green and red lights there, they're on full. which, as I said, is I think is really boring because, like, you know, oh, gee, you have two LEDs and they're plugged into power. Well, that's not really exciting. This is our card. You're welcome to look at it in detail. There's nothing you're going to really, you know, it's going to amaze you of it. They're mostly off-the-shelf parts, an FPGA with a lot of smarts on the FPGA, which you can't really learn anything by looking at the front of it. So I don't really care about that. And this is one thing. Right now it's sending an even number of each category of each packet. There's other ways to do this. I mean, this is the number. The most interesting point about this actually is that the numbers in each category stay the same, which is to say that we didn't happen to lose packets here or there. Every single packet of that category was received, and all the ones rejected were rejected in the right way. The scaling, it's just what's happening is it's going to 10,000 and then it's resetting it to zero for dramatic effect again. This was...
What increments are you going up by?
Pardon me?
Are you incrementing?
Well, what's...
It's just the software
catching up. The, as I see, someone really had fun with the GUI here. If you change the polling interval, then it goes, it's polling every second and every instead of every 2 seconds. So now it looks like it's there. All that's happening is that the GUI is actually interrogating the driver once a second as to what the counts were. Otherwise, you know, you could do it more often, but there's not really any point. You can only draw the lines on the screen so fast anyway. So,
is it possible to see like the CPU use?
Sure, that would be fine. Hoping you would ask. I'm not a KDE guy, so I'm not sure I'll find the right system, utilities. Well, let's try it the old-fashioned way. So here's our X-load meter. That should run. Pardon me? The QT could be heavy. I don't think it's that much of a big deal. I don't know why the load meter's not going and doing anything here. All of our test machines are named after US and Russian astronauts and cosmonauts. Well, astronauts and cosmonauts. This machine is actually Bondar, as in Roberta. This one is Baikonur, which is where Russian things are launched from. And the other machine doesn't have a name because it runs Windows. one of the reasons actually we have another network card in our machine, mostly so that we can load and save our drivers and whatever without, you know, necessarily involving our own hardware that might not be functioning at the moment. I actually have a LAN between the two machines and the smart bits that's in the back here. That's the control LAN. We actually considered having this machine control this. There's a tickle interface to it. But then we realized that it wasn't very definitive if we had one machine that was both being tested and was performing the test on itself. So I felt that was a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit too suspicious. So we kind of, you know, included the right to run the smart bit stuff. So that's there's the Windows PC sitting in behind it. That's VNC. So as I say, this is their nice GUI, which has lots of bugs we've discovered. Yeah.
I saw a couple of months ago a company that has a TCP chip on the network card. Was that you?
Not us. There are a great number of companies that are building accelerators. People doing IP and TCP checksumming on the cards. This card does not do IP or TCP checksumming. It may in the future. It does have an FPGA, which instead of an ASIC, for time to market reasons, and being able to debug things. And we probably will, our next design, which will be an ASIC at gigabit speeds, we'll have the ability to do IP checksums. Whether or not it does TCP checksums or not, that's another question. It's a little bit more difficult, but it's not impossible. It's mostly a question of, do we have time to design it, rather than is it possible? And there's enough other sort of questions. The next card actually will be a PCI card. It won't be a NIC card. Rather, it will be a sort of coprocessor. So you'll put stock NIC cards in the bus, and you'll arrange to have the datagrams stored on the card. And as they flow past the PCI bus into our memory, we will eavesdrop on them as they go by, and we'll perform the classification at that point. Right now, we do a very similar thing. We eavesdrop on the data as it goes from the PHY to the MAC. And we have an arrangement with the MAC where our tag, which is a 32-bit number, gets shoved into the MAC at an appropriate time, and the MAC arranges to DMA it to the receive ring. So, you know, there's some wires going across, but it only works with certain MACs. In this case, the AMD one was compliant, but, you know, we were hoping... We know the packet engine's gigabit MAC is going to work. It won't be a problem. It has a power quick inside. the Altheon has a power quick inside.
Have you tried populating it with a few of those guys?
Yes, it does run with two. We had a second one in this machine, which is in the box underneath, but it does run with two. It's not a problem. We have tried three yet, mostly because we usually run out of PCI slots. Once you have a video card and an auxiliary MAC card, we run out of PCI slots, but we will be putting it pretty much as many as we can fit in the boxes as soon as possible. We have run essentially the same demo you did last year at OCLUG with the QoS stuff through it using the plain software, not doing classification on our card, but just having the data flow through our card. We got numbers that I didn't quite understand, but I think that's mostly because I don't quite know how to use the TC program well enough yet. That's one of our highest priorities, actually, is to do bridging or routing between two cards and to have the QoS go through that.
What are your future plans to avoid ping flooding?
Well, what happens, you see, in a card is our card is capable of classifying at wire speed. So what that means really is that it does it synchronously with the bit stream. So it's guaranteed to always make a decision as to what category the packet belongs in prior to usually DMA starting to move the packet from the MAC into memory. And it's got a pin. The big fat one in the middle is the classifier chip. The one that you can't really see on the far left here is the MAC. It's got a pin that it pulls, which tells the MAC, just by the way, don't bother. I'm rejecting this packet, and it flashes the red light.
How do you base your rejection on if I'm a new person, you know, on?
Well, if you wanted to ignore...
And I've got a hold of a workstation that I shouldn't have, and I decided, you know, I'm going to...
Ping flood guy, yeah. Well, when you found out that, well, first of all, the one point is that you can put ping packets into a category by themselves, into a certain class, and you may allocate them a certain amount of memory to be received, and if someone exceeds that memory, you just start discarding packets. And that would be at a higher level software thing. You just say, well, look, I'm getting packets in this category. I only have 10 buffers available. So if I get 10 more than 10 ping packets, I'm just going to drop the rest. Okay, so you could do essentially incoming quality of service and say ping is a very low interesting, not an interesting service, unless it comes from network management station or something like that. So that would be a more complicated policy. That would require, you know, a higher level thing. We actually could do that. We have this policy that we're seeing here was actually pushed into the card from a tickle-based tester program, which we call H-Tester for hardware tester. That takes and allows you to do it, and you can quite easily in Tickle, you could say what you want. I don't want to get any ping packets from Jamal because he keeps flooding me. Okay, so you could put policies like that. And typically you would have a system that was dynamic. You might say, oh, I don't care about if people want to ping me, until they hit a certain rate. And then it says, whoa, I'm going to put those ping packets in a different class and I'm going to do a new policy on that. You can dynamically change things as you go along. We'd like to have it sophisticated enough such that the TCP socket layer, when it creates a new socket, creates a new category just for that socket. Okay? That would be nice. The problem with that is that the latency for us to update our policy is on the order of 200 or 300 milliseconds. Okay? So it's not fast enough to be able to create a TCP socket thing unless the TCP connection is going to hang around for a while, which means specifically web traffic is not going to be very useful because it typically has a connection time of 2 to 4 seconds and less if in many cases. You don't want to do an update so often. Excuse me. So the general idea is that we'd like to have those things. One of the proposals that was done a long time ago, and if you've read any Unix history, you'll find out that IP, when it was implemented in Edition 6 Unix, it was an IP stack, and TCP was a library that you linked into your application. And one of the things you could do is you could open a socket, and you still see vestiges of this. You can open a raw TCP socket. No one knows what that means because you can't get any packets out of it. But you could do this on an Edition 6 Unix. You could say, I'm interested in TCP packets to port 80. And it would just give you them raw because it didn't have TCP built into it, but it would allocate you port numbers if you wanted to. And the TCP itself lived in user space. By the way, that's one of the ways that NT implements send file, is they actually implement part of this essentially in user space in such a way that they can read the file off the disk to be able to get their web server performance. It's in the kernel, but nothing is really in the kernel in NT because it doesn't really have a kernel. It just has a whole bunch of cooperating DLLs that do things that have different layers. But that's essentially what they're doing, is they have that kind of a thing. And there's been a number of papers that are written that says that the way to do TCP and do it really, really fast is to move TCP into the application. Because the application knows often when it retransmits, when it should, how much data should it send, could it send more data on the retransmit, and other things like that. So there's a real way to do that. But right now, the reason why we have TCP in the kernel is because there's no way to demux based upon port numbers. You can do it in the kernel, set up all the structures.
You're also forgetting the congestion control that's involved, right? I mean, you probably need to do that in the kernel.
There's reasons to leave it in the kernel, and there's reasons to take it out of the kernel. And there's one guy at Toshiba, I think it is. Toshiba? No, not Shichi. It's called... The company's called HAL. It's a subsidiary of Fujitsu, and they did a 64-bit Spark architecture before the Ultra Sparks were really available. I think they probably disappeared, but I don't know for sure. But they had an interesting idea. They had a concept called domain space, which was where X servers would live. They would be user processes, but they would have essentially kernel-like privileges, and our X servers sort of have that. And they would also say TCP would live there, because it should be able to have all access to all these timers and things that it needs in the kernel. But it should actually be threaded in a way that you can spread it across multiple CPUs and push it as close to the application as possible.
It's kind of dangerous to trust the application.
It would have limited access, meaning it would be able to do certain calls into the kernel at a much quicker interface. And it would have a limited trust in the sense that probably only a super user could install them, because it probably could mess things up, but it wouldn't be able to crash the system quite the way that a kernel thread can. Yeah, it is a lot. It is a lot in concept to the microkernel concept, but it's more of a concept that is in between. It's not heard. Nor is it single threaded. You know, unit kernel. It's half in between. So it sort of gets some benefits from both and some disadvantages of both, probably. As I say, it's not something that I think they've implemented yet or done anything with. But as an idea, as the concept is that if you can get access to the data stream, and things like, for instance, a thing in this would be able to set up his transmit buffers, slap some TCP on front of it. So he'd literally take. And we have. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the send file thing. I think someone's going to talk about it this afternoon. But the idea is that you have a file on disk, and what you arrange is you say to the kernel, I would like you to send it out this socket. And the kernel arranges to page fault the file in to its address space, slap on the appropriate TCP headers and checksums, and And then it asks the network card to please do scatter gather and DMA all this stuff out the network card. And it may be in some architectures you can even arrange to have virtual DMA happen and have the network card take the page fault. It doesn't happen on Intel, but it can happen on Spark because you can do virtual DMA on Spark. And it's a funny thing to do. You're like, why would that be an advantage? But the advantage is that often the packets are, the data is already in memory and you can just send it. Anything else anyone wants to see?
Did you support hierarchical classification?
Pardon me?
Can you do hierarchical classification?
By the sense that you have one category that is then split into multiple categories and then multiple categories?
A tree.
A tree, yeah. And generally, we are attempting to get away from hierarchical classification and go to one layer of classification. So if you want to have a hierarchy of classes, that's okay. But we would once you've put them through as they go into the hardware, they've been converted, as we say, from filters to classifiers, then what happens is that, in fact, the hierarchy has been flattened into one layer.
So you have priorities.
You have priorities between the different filters. Essentially, what we do is we define a classifier as being the result of running filters in a certain priority over the incoming data stream. But we run all the filters in parallel, is one way to think of it. A better way to think of it is we take all the filters and we turn it into a programmable state machine. And that's what we actually run with. Or we turn it into a state machine that gets programmed into a programmable state machine. But more precise statement. So if you want to have hierarchies of different things, for instance, this is an IP packet. This is an IP packet destined to node 4, this is an IP packet destined to node 4 that was HTTP, you would write a couple of filters and you would instantiate parameters that you're interested, node 4, HTTP, and you would then say, well, probably the one that's more specific is higher priority. If you're doing routing, you just plain old routing, longest match is the best match, well, you would say that has the higher priority when you put it in. And because there's a system of priorities, there's two ways of doing it. There's, in the current revision of the software, there's basically priority high, priority low, and you have to put it in a certain order. The new revision, which is coming out this fall, the priorities actually are much, much more complicated in order to support adding and subtracting filters from it, because there's some problems that you can't remove a filter from the middle, but that's sort of an API problem more than an inside problem.
So you see sort of a list of filters and you process all of them?
Yeah.
Then you just take them and
provide
priority.
Generally, we order them by priority and process them until we get one that says reject or accept. The other ones simply do not match.
Okay. And you do it sequentially?
Pardon me?
You do it sequentially.
We don't do it sequentially.
Oh,
we use an optimizer. We take the filters and we have a representation for them and we turn it into a state machine. That's what the 200 or 300 milliseconds update time is the software thinking about what the right way to do this is.
Well, it sounds a bit like Xfinity do it. What are the elements of the state machine?
Well, if you like, essentially, every time a bit arrives out of the cable, the state machine changes state. So there's a state machine that has a whole bunch of nodes. Each one has two outputs, 0, 1, etc. So every time a bit arrives off the wire, the state machine changes state. At some point, it reaches a terminal node, and the terminal node says, aha, it's category 4, and that's the answer. Or it says it's category 0, which means reject, and the red light goes on, and the packet gets dropped on the floor. Pardon me? No. although it has at times been a human debugged state machine, and if you had watched me or someone else do this, you would have seen us basically sitting on the floor with a lot of paper around us going, okay, here and here and here. And it's fortunately, we have written some tools that make it a bit easier to debug, and at this point we're sufficiently certain about our algorithms that they're no longer problems. Wojtek, we have a mathematician who works for us who does some of this, the theoretical background, and he's shown some things that we instinctually knew that were to be true. He's proven them, and he's also told us that our algorithms could be the complexity of them should be much lower than actually we experience. So we're very happy about that, and we're busy working on a new next generation of algorithms, because that 200 to 300 milliseconds, and sometimes more, to instantiate a new class is just too high for a lot of people. They'd like to have, well, the really, really eager beavers would like to have a new filter created after every packet. Okay, and that's a reasonable thing to do if you're trying to do network analyzers, where you see a new TCP flow, and boom, you want to put it in a new class, and you want to do it before the next packet arrives, because it could be part of that flow too. And we can't do that at this point. But if you have a static concept, you know, I want to do routing. Routing doesn't change that often. Okay, it takes 5 minutes for BGP to finish thinking about what the route should be anyway. So if it takes 200 or 300 milliseconds to instantiate the routes, that's okay. The other side is people want to do firewalling, which tends to have fairly static policies. Yes, there are dynamic policies in the sense that, you know, you have the FTP port and all that other stuff, but it's easily handled within the context of one or several static policies that allow you to do what you want to do, or dealing with it in a default case for what's going on. And you can create some dynamic stuff, and we have some code that does that. We actually fit the routing table for May East in this card. It's got 384 kilowords of pattern memory, we call it, of programmable state machine. So our word is about 50 bits wide. So I say words, not bytes. And we fit the 56,000 entries from May East into the routing table. May West has about 100,000 routes and doesn't quite fit in this card. Okay, but you know, this is a prototype rather than a real card, and it also depends a bit upon how many destination routes you have. Yeah.
Does it heat a lot?
Pardon me?
Does it heat a lot?
No, actually. We had one card that's on display. It's in a display case for marketing people to do their thing, and we killed it with cold spray. Okay? I didn't do this. Some other people did this some of us were on vacation and they were getting frustrated because there was a bug, and it had nothing to do with the heat, but heat, the cooling, it seemed to make it a lot better, and it had to do with the fact that the crystal on this was just 0.5% slower than the crystal on this. And there was some, you know, it shouldn't have been a problem, and we've solved that problem. But one of the interesting things they observed on the whole thing was that this is our big one there is our classification chip, and that's the one that should be heating up, right? The next chip there is a PCI target adapter that sits in front of the classification chip so that, you know, the host can actually talk to it and program it. And that's the hottest chip. The AMCC chip there is the hottest chip on the board. Everything else runs like cold, room temperature or better. The AMCC chip's like, well, that's pretty warm. What does this chip do? Nothing. It's just, you know, there's nothing else is there. All the other chips are quite cool. We have one patch on the back, one wire patch on it. Hardware designer's guy who does a lot of rescue work for most of the big names in Ottawa. He gets called in when they're 6 months into their design, or they've been debugging their hardware for 6 months and they still don't know what's wrong. And he comes in and helps them. So he's seen all of the errors that you could possibly make, and you know, he was really pedantic and wasted. We thought at the time wasted a lot of time doing, you know, needless, endless design reviews. But one of the effects of it is that the cards worked right from the first one, and we didn't have any problems. There was no heat issues and whatever. So we still have one problem with there's something wrong with running it at 10 megabits if you let it auto negotiate. We haven't figured that one out yet. It's not us. It's something to do with level one. Where if I switch it to 10 megabits, I'll have to reboot the computer for unexplainable reasons. But that's not something that we figure is a big deal. If someone wants to run it at 10 megabits, well, you know, we'll give them a little jumper, and that'll solve the problem for now.
When you were looking at your performance under Linux for just the Intel chip,
right?
Did you have to write your own software then to the whole processor to get the right something?
No, it's actually in the code. You do have to rebuild your kernel and specify that you have a Pentium or Pentium Pro or K6 processor or better. It's there. If you compile your kernel to be more generic, it compiles out that instruction or that call.
What do you get from this profile, though? You just get
there's a call called get cycles in the kernel. It's a single instruction. If you want to use it in user space, you probably could just copy that code out of timex.h. User include Linux timex. Pardon me? Yeah, it's one ASMS instruction. It's pretty. It's just cut and pasted into your code, and it will work just fine. K5 does not implement it. K5 is really a 486 core from AMD. K6 does implement the get cycles. TDRSC. I think that's it. Instruction, and basically what it does is it loads. There's a 64-bit counter in the CPU, and it loads that gets reset at reset time. And on every clock tick, whether you're running it, you know, if you have a notebook and it goes, you know, high and low clock rates and whatever, your count won't reflect real time. It will reflect CPU cycles, right? And what it does is it loads the low bits into EAX and the high bits into EDX. And in this case, the function only returns the low 32 bits. But unless you're doing very, very long time elapsed measurements, 32 bits is plenty. So all I do is at the beginning of a routine I'm interested in, I get the time, I get the cycles, and at the end I get the cycles, and I subtract the number and I add it to an accumulator, and I increment another number. And then at the end of everything, when I want a result, I then go and do the division to find out what the average rate was. Well, I know that there are tools from Digital that run under Digital Unix, and actually a really, really good article on optimizing in two issues ago of Semicolon Login on optimizing SQID on Alpha. And there were some rewrites in the code and some movements of the structure to make cache line hits better. And it actually does a static analysis of your code. So they have and it says, well, this instruction is going to cause a pipeline flush, and this instruction is going to cause the data is not going to be ready yet, and it does a predictive thing based on knowledge of how big your L1 and L2 caches are, or whatever.
More than just, you don't want just to know this is how many cycles, you want L1 caches and this is L2.
Well, this will tell you all those things. I don't care about all those things actually. Right. I mean, Digital knows about all these things, and on Digital Unix, it does the right thing. Right. There are lots of tools to do this. The thing is that I'm not so interested in, these tools were very interesting because they told him, how to rearrange his data structures, and that would be very interesting to have. But I'm not aware of a tool that will do this for Intel for what I have.
VTune.
VTUNE?
Yeah, VTUNE. It's written by Intel, but it's pretty. It's not very.
Do I have to run it under Windows or something?
Yeah.
So I have to somehow arrange to compile my code and then have it examine it or something. And yeah. I mean, it's certainly doable. It's certainly doable. The key thing that we discovered was that, in general, in debugging these things, is that we had a lot of problems. That turned out to be subtle hardware problems, in terms of because we have memory here and it's multi-ported, and we have an arbiter that selects between the multiple people who need to use the memory, being the host, be it the Mac, be it the classification engine. And we had just some subtle little bugs, like a 64-bit write would sometimes have the upper 32 bits go into not the next location but a location two after it. Little subtle things like that. But it would only occur when we were pumping at 100 megabits per second. So when there was some, we spent, a month or so dealing with problems like this. One of the things that we discovered is the problem is that when it's running so fast, we can't do printfs out of it. Because that influences the code to the extent that the behavior changes. So, you know, one of the things we wound up doing is we wound up having various circular buffers. We'd print f into the circular buffer and then dump things later on when we're happy. And in some cases, that was too slow. You know, all that formatting took too long. Okay, we just dumped the numbers we were interested into an array. Who cares, you know, if they're structures? They're just integers. We just dumped them into the array and we dumped them out afterwards. And the CPU cycle counters thing was a thing we realized that we couldn't do a real measurement here, in as it's running. So we had to just gather the minimum amount of data possible to get the information we want, and then, you know, do anything else. Like even the division, I didn't want to put the division in the loop to figure out the average number each time. That's not interesting. I want to know the average over 10,000 runs. So what we've done now, and the latest piece of code has been rewritten to have to use a lot of pointers instead of array indexing. A number of other things, and is in a state of, I've broken something and nothing works in the process of rewriting it, so I have to undo some things and see what I broke. But we're particularly interested in we suspect that one of the reasons the number is so high in servicing the packet, because all it's really got to do is set one bit in memory. And that essentially tells the MAC chip that ring descriptor is now available for use again. That's pretty simple. Ideally, it also looks at our classification result and increments the counter. Still, you know, 5 or 6 bus cycles to get that information and a couple cycles to do the addition, and maybe a couple to do a multiplication to figure out which counter to increment. Shouldn't be a big deal. But we're putting some counters, and we're wondering if maybe some it's going through some data flows which we had thought we haven't commented out, but they shouldn't be going through that. The conditions should be such that it's not doing that. Maybe what we're going to discover is that some of the packets are actually going through the bottom layer half. They're not supposed to, but they are. I don't know that. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what there it's going to be. Anybody else? Yeah. Right. It's going to be a problem. 66 megahertz, 64-bit wide PCI buses, okay, will let you build a router at gigabit, a two-port router at gigabit. Okay? There is enough bandwidth there. It depends on how efficiently you think you're going to be able to use the PCI bus. All right? Secondly, someone who's building such a thing on PC, and there are people that do want to do that, people in the analyzer business, for instance, some of them would like to snoop on a full duplex gigabit flow, which means essentially they have to have two receivers. They're receiving two gigabits of data, one in each direction. And they're like, well, okay, so we won't be able to buy an off-the-shelf Joe's Clone Shop motherboard. Okay? I don't know if you've seen them. I've seen some kernel print, you know, dump messages from FreeBSD boxes mostly, where it's mostly descriptive. And you can buy motherboards that have 12 PCI slots. And they have several PCI bridges between the CPU and the host. And you can put a gigabyte, if you want, of memory on each, you know, so you have 2 gigabit cards, some memory. And then you have 4 more slots, 2 gigabit cards, and some memory. So now you've split the bandwidth across 2 PCI buses. And the host, you know, if you have some processing on that, on either the NIC cards or on the memory card, then you can actually have the host, you know, just, you know, sit there and supervise and doesn't have to do anything else. But you're right. Generally speaking, at gigabit speeds, people are talking about pumping it into some kind of switch fabric. There's actually a group called C6, C-S-I-X, C6.org. Unfortunately, they are not a very public standards organization. They're membership only kind of thing. which basically consists of some of the people building switch fabrics and some of the people building gigabit max and OC12 and OC48 drop muxes. And they want to have a standard by which you can interface different switch fabrics to different MACs. And one of the things that they haven't quite realized yet, but they're realizing, is that a switch fabric is not necessarily just used for networking. You can put a switch fabric on your motherboard just to connect all your CPUs together and your memory and your network cards. So that may not be so wildly off in the future. Pardon me?
AMD just announced something.
Yeah.
So it's eight-way processors with switch fabric.
With switch fabric between them, yeah.
SGI does it.
Pardon me?
SGI does it.
SGI, that's true. SGI has done that with their 12 and 20 CPU challenges for years. They've had essentially a fabric between them, and that's not unusual. So, I mean, it's not crazy. I mean, people also, you know, talk about having fiber channel and whatever between NIC cards, and weirdly enough.
You can
Yeah, well, that was to say, weirdly enough, we've actually had SCSI people come and talk to us. And we're like, why? You're at make hard disks. And they said, yes, but SCSI is not smart enough for us. We want to have NFS on our hard disk. Hey, like, I still have in my basement a Sun 3 with a 20 megahertz 68020 on it, right? And it had a 600 meg hard disk with a 68020 on it. I'm like, put the hard disk and a printer on a 286, and you should do your processing on your hard disk, not on your on your system at the time. But I mean, it's not unusual. And hey, look, the only thing hard disks don't have is enough RAM right now to do that. And with 64 meg SIMs being pretty cheap now, that's not such a big deal anymore. If you want to build some kind of, you know, use virtual router redundancy protocol to load balance between the different hard disks, and you do mirroring over your network, not over your SCSI bus. And I'm like, oh, okay, so you want to do that? I'm like, oh, okay. Some of these people are also concerned about doing things like having the reason they want to have a RAID that actually operates with the disks physically separate, like on opposite sides of the continent, kind of separate. And they want to have quality of service connecting them. And this is mostly for redundancy, for in the event of situations like Friday in Toronto, when you can't get across the network and you'd like to have the disk locally, please, in case of emergency. So there are people doing like that, and they won't care. Gigabit will be just fine, and it will go right into their disk and their cache, and they'll write it out to their to the right sectors at the appropriate time, I presume. Pardon me? We don't do that a lot. We have our device driver, which is a PCNet32 plus a lot of stuff. Essentially what it offers is we have this 3 megabytes of RAM on the card, and what it offers is the ability to mmap it into a device, into a user space. So that's how it actually operates. The likelihood is that what we're going to do is that there's going to be a Netlink-ish like protocol that allows a kernel to request to a user space daemon, please instantiate the following filter, and then it will go install it on the card, mostly because we need a certain amount of memory, which is probably not reasonably to put in the kernel at this time. It's also much easier to debug when it's not in the kernel, right? So we do the minimum there, and then one of the other side effects of this is that we can release our driver quite easily without risking any of our intellectual property that way. Eventually, all the source code will get released under GPL, essentially, or something that sounds very much like it. That's right, exactly. Our IP is really in the card itself, so our software, although it's actually most of the effort, is not the part that we're interested in selling. But at the same time, the knowledge of what's in our card is in our software, and so we're not really willing to, you know, tell things. There's some magic that I haven't told you and I won't tell you about. That why our card works, and people at Cisco and Bay and CMU who tried this in the past decade are, you know, they didn't succeed because the amount of memory they needed grew exponentially with the number of bits they wanted to process. And ours grows linearly, and that's because of some interesting algorithms. But essentially, you know, we're not in the software selling business. We want to sell ASICs, and we need software to run them, but we need operating systems to incorporate it. So we're quite happy to just say, you know, here you go. On the other hand, we want to make sure we actually have an ASIC to sell you before we start telling everyone what's going on. You know, it takes 9 months to build an ASIC, and we're 2 or 3 months into that for our gigabit ASIC. Anybody else? It's 10:30 now, actually, so I think they're feeding us. I don't know. Thank you very much for coming. I'm glad to see so many interested people.